You're listening to West Virginia Week, a regular podcast from West Virginia Public Broadcasting that looks back at the major stories of the week. I'm your host this week, Maria Young. On this West Virginia Week, how West Virginia senators voted on the Congressional Rescission Bill. We'll tell you about a key victory in court for anti-abortion activists in this state. Also, a little bakery is getting a big moment to shine, and the surging popularity of something called the home wrecker. Let's jump right in now with a few short news stories. U.S. Senator Shelley Moore Capito says public broadcasting, which partially funds local stations, including this one, will have to find other ways to sustain itself. That after she and Senator Jim Justice joined other Republican senators in voting to eliminate its federal funding. Curtis Tate has more.
Capito was among 51 Republicans who voted at 2 a.m. Thursday to strip $1.1 billion in already approved funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. West Virginia Public Broadcasting and other public media organizations, especially in rural regions, rely on federal funding to support their operations. But President Donald Trump threatened to withdraw his endorsement of anyone who voted against the rescission package. Capito is up for re-election next year.
I would like to see West Virginia Public Broadcasting and our local radio be able to sustain itself through other mechanisms, whether it's more state funding, more donations.
Early last year, Capito received an award from America's public television stations for her support of public broadcasting. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Curtis Tate in Charleston.
Meanwhile, West Virginia senators are leading a charge to free up federal education funding. Chris Schultz has more.
Senator Shelley Moore Capito wrote a letter Wednesday to Russell Vaux, director of the White House's Office of Management and Budget, urging him to release more than $6 billion in education grants. States normally receive federal education funds for programs like before and after school enrichment and adult education on July 1st. But on June 30th, the U.S. Education Department notified state education officials that it was withholding the money until a review of the funds can be completed. Capito warns that not releasing the funds from the congressionally approved continuing resolution signed by President Trump in March will harm students, families, and local economies. Senator Jim Justice was one of the 9 other Senate Republicans that signed the letter. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Chris Schultz in Morgantown.
The 8th and final former correctional officer charged in connection with the March 2022 beating death of an inmate at the Southern Regional Jail in Beaver has been sentenced. Appearing Monday before U.S. District Court Judge Joseph Goodwin, Andrew Fleshman received a prison term of 8 years and 4 months, according to a press release from the Department of Justice. Fleshman admitted to joining other officers in escorting Quantes Burks to an interview room where they struck and injured him while restrained, handcuffed, and posing no threat. The beating, Fleshman admitted, was to punish the man for attempting to leave his assigned pod. Of the 7 other defendants, 6 pleaded guilty and 1 was convicted at trial. Since May, they have all been sentenced to prison terms ranging from 3 to 21 years. 6 coal ash sites in West Virginia or on its borders fall under a federal rule issued last year, but the rule's fate is uncertain. Curtis Tate has more.
One of the less-known rules the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency rolled out in the final months of the Biden administration required companies to examine the condition of coal ash disposal sites at inactive power plants. 6 such sites ring West Virginia, according to the group Earth Justice, and they pose hazards to rivers and groundwater. Coal ash contains mercury, arsenic, selenium, chromium, and a variety of other substances that can damage human health. Lisa Evans, senior counsel for Earth Justice, says such sites are not monitored or inspected.
So these are ponds that are not inspected, not maintained, and not monitored. So actually the impact on the environment at these sites is mostly not known.
They may not be lined or capped either, and their contents can seep into groundwater. Electric Utilities filed a lawsuit over the rule in the U.S. Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia. The case is ongoing. EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin said in March the agency would revisit the rule. Evans says the rule imposes the same standards on inactive coal ash sites as it does at ones where a power plant still operates.
So there has to be inspections, there has to be a groundwater monitoring system installed, there has to be a determination of whether the coal ash pond is contaminating groundwater.
And if contamination is found, the company has to clean it up. Karen Wissing, a spokeswoman for Appalachian Power, says it's assessing two of the sites on the Kanawha River at Cabin Creek in Glasgow and will submit a plan to the EPA. Its Glen Lynn site on the New River just across the border in Virginia will be remediated according to Virginia law, she said. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Curtis Tate in Charleston.
An advisory body for the West Virginia Division of Natural Resources is piloting a new meeting format in an effort to boost public engagement. Jack Walker reports.
The Natural Resources Commission will host its next meeting July 24 at 5 p.m. But this time, the meeting will be simulcast to six locations across West Virginia, specifically in Beckley, Charleston, Elkins, Farmington, Parkersburg, and Romney. The new meeting format aims to bolster public participation from different corners of the state. According to a meeting agenda, the commission is set to discuss hunting and fishing policies for 2026 and ruffed grouse population regrowth efforts. The commission will also take public comments. The meeting can be accessed via live stream as well. For more information, visit our website at wvpublic.org. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jack Walker in Shepherdstown.
The State Board of Education has announced it will pursue legal action against the Secretary of State. Chris Schultz has the details.
The West Virginia Board of Education announced Monday afternoon that Secretary of State Chris Warner had rejected a policy the board approved during a special meeting earlier in the day. At that meeting, the board voted unanimously to approve a new policy related to minimum requirements for school vehicles. As Kelly Talbot, General Counsel for the West Virginia Department of Education, explained to the board, the normally routine action has been made anything but after House Bill 2755 became effective law July 11th. The law requires board policies to go through the Legislative Oversight Commission on Education Accountability and the full legislature for approval, rejection, or modification before those policies can become effective, something Talbot says the board maintains is unconstitutional.
By voting to file it with the Secretary of State with an effective date, you're challenging the purported requirements of House Bill 2755. In other words, we're proposing that this rule go into effect 30 days upon filing, not after it goes through the full legislature for an effective date.
The State Board of Education voted to pursue litigation against the bill at their May 14th meeting. There have been several attempts by the legislature to gain oversight of the board's rulemaking authority over public education. Most recently, voters in 2022 rejected a constitutional amendment on the ballot that would have required the board to submit its rules and policies to the legislature. This was the third meeting of the board this month. Besides their regular meeting held last Wednesday, July 9th, the board also met July 2nd to discuss a separate lawsuit related to school vaccine requirements. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Chris Schultz in Morgantown.
An insulation manufacturer in Jefferson County has obtained a new air monitoring permit. Jack Walker reports.
Rockwool operates a steel wool production facility in the city of Ranson. The West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection granted the site a new operational permit this month. This document is required of all industrial sites deemed a minor source of air emissions. Previously, Rockwool had been listed as a major source of emissions, but the company said its status was reduced after it switched from coal to natural gas. These permits require documentation that minor emission sites are adhering to state laws surrounding air pollution. The Ranson plant has long faced public concern over its potential impacts on the environment, and especially to local air quality. Its new permit takes effect Tuesday. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jack Walker in Shepherdstown.
The 13-state electricity grid that includes West Virginia may not be ready for the expected growth in data centers. Curtis Tate has the story.
PJM, which includes part or all of 12 states in the District of Columbia, hasn't kept up with new investments in generation and transmission to support data centers. That's what John Gordon, director of Advanced Energy United, told energy journalists during a Zoom presentation Wednesday. Gordon says the critical infrastructure in PJM is 50 to 60 years old, and electricity demand is increasing as older power plants are retired.
A data center can be built much more quickly than the infrastructure needed to support it. So you have a kind of an inherent mismatch there.
PJM has been slow to approve new resources, especially renewables, to connect to the grid. Gordon says policymakers will have to keep the data center build-out from harming electricity consumers and grid reliability. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Curtis Tate in Charleston.
A few months ago, it was the USA Cycling Championships. Now the city of Charleston is planning another major sporting event to draw visitors and attract tourism dollars. The West Virginia Mountaineers and the Wake Forest Demon Deacons will tip off in the 2025 Holiday Hoop Fest. The contest will take place at the Charleston Coliseum on December the 6th. The non-conference matchup will mark just the 11th time the two teams have played each other in more than 70 years, dating back to 1948. So far, WVU leads the series 7-3. Convention and Visitors Bureau President Tim Brady says with two loyal fan bases, the game will be a tourism draw during a fun-filled holiday time for Charleston. Pre-sale begins September 2nd with tickets available to the public starting on September the 5th. The two teams will face off again at a date still to be determined during the 2026-27 season in Greensboro, North Carolina. A small Huntington bakery with a foreign flair is enjoying some national recognition. Randy Yowie has more.
The Nomada Bakery in Huntington's Heritage Station is USA Today's best cake shop in the U.S., receiving the 10 Best Readers' Choice Award. Owner and head baker Ariel Barcena says Nomada is nomad in Spanish, and his bakery name and culinary creations are rooted in his native Panama and South American upbringing. Barcena says his inspiration comes from his grandmother's Panama kitchen. Nomada's mission is to bake classic items like the Alfajores cookie that she once made.
Good sweets, made with care, with real ingredients, like our grandmas used to bake.
Barcena says the coffee served with his pastries is exclusively imported from Panama. And the USA Today Award has increased patrons from out of town and locals just discovering the Nomada Bakery. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Randy Yowie in Huntington.
You're listening to West Virginia Week. And now, some of our top feature stories from the past week. On Tuesday, West Virginia's abortion ban law won a victory in federal court. As Chris Schultz reports, it upholds the state's ability to control another option for anyone in this state who wants to terminate a pregnancy.
The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld a 2023 district court ruling in GenBioPro Inc. versus Christina Raines that West Virginia can restrict the sale of abortion medication. GenBioPro manufactures a generic version of mifepristone. The medication is used in conjunction with misoprostol for medical abortions and can be taken at home. The company's lawsuit claims West Virginia and then Attorney General Patrick Morrissey violated federal law by prohibiting the sale of the drug. Sean Tu is a nationally recognized expert on patent and drug law and a professor at the University of Alabama School of Law. He says Tuesday's decision upholds states' rights to restrict access to medication beyond the Food and Drug Administration's regulations.
The Fourth Circuit says that this is really a separation of states' rights and federal rights, and typically you can have more restrictive laws.
The FDA has a regulatory scheme that has deemed mifepristone to be safe and effective, but also imposed a risk evaluation and mitigation strategy for what they consider high-risk drugs.
The state has argued that's the floor. And if we want to have more restrictive laws and say that you have to jump through extra hoops to use this drug safely, then we're going to make you jump through these extra hoops.
As Attorney General, Morrissey defended the state's abortion ban against the suit. Tuesday, he said he was proud to see a victory in the case. Passed during a special session of the West Virginia Legislature in September 2022, House Bill 302 defines abortion to include the use of any medicine, drug, or other substance with intent to terminate a pregnancy. In January 2023, GenBioPro brought suit in the United States District Court for the Southern District of West Virginia, arguing that West Virginia's law overrode congressional authorization for the FDA to exclusively impose restrictions on access to mifepristone via the Food and Drug Administration Amendment Act of 2007. In a published opinion for the three-judge panel that presided over the case, Judge Harvey Wilkinson ruled that the act leaves states free to regulate access to medication in their jurisdiction. He clarified that states are certainly not free to dilute federal safety standards where they have been clearly established, or that Congress could not preempt state abortion laws if it chooses to do so. Quote, We simply hold that Congress must express that intention with the clarity befitting such a significant alteration to our system of dual sovereignty, Wilkinson said. Margaret Chapman Pomponio is the executive director of West Virginia Free, a reproductive health advocacy organization. She says the ruling won't immediately change what is happening in West Virginia for the average person, but it does contribute to a set of policies stacked against everyday West Virginians who need to terminate a pregnancy.
West Virginia Free is disappointed by this decision, but not surprised.
She says West Virginians have been living in a very difficult landscape with regard to reproductive health even before the legislature banned abortion.
We have maternity deserts in our state. We have abortion deserts. And so our work as advocates and educators is to try to get West Virginians the information and the resources they need to make the best decisions for their own reproductive lives and bodies.
Pomponio says mifepristone is the most common form of pregnancy termination, and bans across the country have not stopped people from seeking out the treatment.
You know, we always knew that banning abortion would not stop abortion. It just makes it much harder to get. These bans are really cruel, not just on women and people who can become pregnant, but their families, friends, and their employers. And this ruling just makes it that much harder.
GenBioPro can appeal the decision to the U.S. Supreme Court, but the company has not indicated such action is forthcoming at this time. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Chris Schultz in Morgantown.
Research from the Feeding America organization shows more than 250,000 West Virginians get healthy food through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. Their research also notes the just-passed federal reconciliation bill will eventually shift more than $80 million of SNAP costs to the state. Randy Yowie spoke with Cindy Kirkhart, CEO of the Huntington-based Facing Hunger Food Bank, on how these SNAP changes may affect thousands of Appalachians, many of them already living in food deserts.
Cindy, what does the food bank do, and who does it serve and where?
We serve 12 counties in West Virginia, 4 counties in eastern Kentucky, and Lawrence County, Ohio. On good days, we're serving about 130,000 souls. But right now we're seeing an uptick of about 24%, so that put us about $156,000.
How are you funded? What's your annual budget?
You know, we have a lot of direct donations from the public, but we also receive a good amount of grant funding, and then we have some administrative funding from the Department of Agriculture.
How does it work? How do you get the food, and where does it go?
So about 40% of our food is considered donated, but that includes the food resources commodities that we receive from the Department of Ag. We have a really robust retail donation, Kroger's and Walmart's, that we pick up from there. And then what we don't get donated, we purchase.
And then where does it go? How does it get distributed?
We have a network of about 253 partner agencies. So we go out into the counties where those pantries and service providers are and directly distribute to them. We have folks that come in and pick up product directly from the food bank. Then we do mobile pantry distributions, backpack distributions, and then our other programming.
So explain briefly what SNAP benefits are and how that relates to the food bank and its customers or clients.
SNAP benefits are basically what we used to refer to as food stamps. So that is that supplemental nutrition assistance program. So for families that live in poverty, they receive SNAP benefits through an EBT card that then they can go out and make direct purchases of foods that they prefer. A lot of what the food bank may have to provide to them maybe isn't a choice product for them. So it is supplemental for them to be able to go out and purchase those foods that they need for their families.
How will the provisions of the federal reconciliation bill, the big beautiful bill, the budget bill, whatever you want to call it, how will that affect West Virginians who use your food services?
We understand that some of these changes won't come into play right now, okay? But things like the tariffs are coming into play. So those typically hit lower income families harder. because a lot of the tariffs are on products that are cheaper, made in China and that type of thing. So they're going to start feeling pinches in their income. Then when the SNAP cuts come through, you know, a lot of that's being pushed down to the state level. And with the state having to make some determinations about that programming, because now they're going to have to deal with the administrative and the benefits. Governor Morrissey has a challenge, right? He's going to have to determine how he's going to implement and sustain that program. So the financial cuts will come to the state. Then the state's going to have to decide who's going to get those benefits. And Randy, we both know that it's typically per person in a family, $6 a day. Now, you and I would probably be very challenged to feed a family on $6 a day per person. It is equally challenging for those families. So we're looking at then a higher demand for the food bank. And you and I have talked previously, very recently, that our food resources from the Department of Ag have been cut by a significant amount. So we're really right now starting to look at what can we do to feed families for the next couple of years.
The reconciliation bill provisions don't really go into effect until late 2026, as we've said. Does that time frame offer any chances of solving problems?
I think that we have established a very positive relationship with the West Virginia legislature, and we look forward to continuing to develop our partnership with the governor. That is our only recourse right now, is how collectively can we work together to address what we understand is coming down the road. I think we've got great partners like Delegate Evan Worrell and Speaker Hanshaw, folks who have always understood the needs of hungry West Virginians who want people to have healthy food. So we're hoping to parlay that into additional support to ensure that we don't add to hungry West Virginian rosters.
Anything else on this subject that you want to offer that I didn't ask?
I think it's incredibly important for our members of Congress to be listening to the information that we provide to them and help us collectively as a state address what is clearly a hunger tsunami coming down the road.
That was Facing Hunger Food Bank CEO Cindy Kirkhart speaking with Randy Yowie on the future of SNAP benefits in West Virginia. In 25 years, Hillbilly Hot Dogs in LeSage has become a local institution and an attraction for travelers from all over the world. Last summer, one of its signature items, the Homewrecker, suddenly became unavailable. But it's back. Inside Appalachia's Bill Lynch paid a visit to the hot dog stand and brings us this story.
It was the middle of the week at Hillbilly Hot Dogs in LeSage, about 10 miles north of Huntington. People were lined up outside waiting to get lunch inside and get out of the summer heat. Hillbilly Hot Dogs is more than a typical West Virginia hot dog stand. It's a bona fide roadside attraction. The lot is an eccentric collection of rustic-looking buildings covered in graffiti, repurposed school buses, and reclaimed junk, poking fun at hillbilly stereotypes. The restaurant has tables inside and out, but also offers dining on the roof, which is a good place for a quirky first date if it's not too hot. There's also a wedding chapel out back if things turn serious. Reservations for lunch are not required, but probably call ahead if you're thinking about booking a wedding. Sonny and Sherry Knight opened Hillbilly Hot Dogs in 1999.
Sonny and I were sitting out underneath a tree. This old house up here on the hill, Sonny was one of 11 children. And we were sitting out under the tree and I said, honey, why don't you just plow that land over there and build me a weenie stand. And the 12 by 16 building was built with him and his brothers and brothers-in-law. And I soon learned that in order for them to build, I had to keep a pickup truck right in front of the place and a couple cases of beer. And then they just worked till the sun was coming up the next day. It was nonstop. But if you took away the truck or you took away the beer, nobody worked. We opened September 6th of 99 and closed 3 days later and got married. And everyone thought for sure these two nuts, me and Sonny, were both from California, when it's just me that is, because who opens a business and 3 days later closes it to get married? We did. We did.
The place expanded as it went, adding buildings, buses, and a variety of specialty hot dogs. Hillbilly Hot Dog is included on various travel lists and was featured on Guy Fieri's Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. Sonny passed away in 2021. Since then, it's just been Sherry overseeing the restaurant with a lot of help. The menu at Hillbilly Hot Dogs has expanded since it opened, mostly through trial and error. The menu currently lists over 25 specialty hot dogs, but I wasn't there for any of that. I'd come for the homewrecker. The homewrecker is a deep-fried, one-pound, all-beef hot dog. That's like an entire package of hot dogs.
Sonny wanted something that nobody else had. So we went to our food packing company and he said, you know, 15-inch, all beef. And Buddy Logan looked at us and said, it's a novelty. No, it's not going to last. And I turned around as Sonny was walking out the door and I looked at Buddy Logan and I said, you gave us 3 months. Make the dog for him. Just do it. Just make it. So he came into the store and he had a frozen prototype, threw it down the table. It was frozen and it just kind of bounced. And my brother was standing there and he went, now there's a homewrecker. And right there, we got the name.
With toppings, a table of three or four could probably share the hot dog, but Sonny wanted something to attract a particular kind of diner. One with something to prove. The Knights put the word out. They wanted to see how fast someone could eat a homewrecker.
So one guy, David Frankie, he was a student at Marshall, and he did it in 12 minutes. And we knew, okay, we got our set time, because it took him everything he had to do 12 minutes. So now from there, we've gone down to the 2 minutes and 34 seconds. I think it's 32. So 232 is, I think, what it is now. Yeah.
There isn't really a strategy to getting that much food down. But the kitchen manager, Cecilia Cottle, said having a cup of water doesn't hurt. I thought I'd try my luck and my stomach against the homewrecker. Waitress Katie Thacker counted me down.
All right, so you get 12 minutes or less to eat the whole thing. And if you do so, you get a free t-shirt and post it on the Facebook page. If you beat the record of 2 minutes and 34 seconds, which, cake, you got it, you get the whole thing refunded back to you. The thing is, you don't have to lick the plate clean, but you can't leave any chunks of tomatoes or jalapenos. You also can't share with your friends, throw it out the window, or tuck it in your boots for later, okay? It's just the rules. All right, any comments, questions, concerns? Nope. All righty, I'm going to count down from three and give you a big old yee-haw. 3, 2, 1, yee-haw!
And like that, I was off. I had a cup of water and a plastic knife. I used the knife to cut off pieces of the giant hot dogs that fit in my mouth. The dog was as big around as the handle of a broom, and it was piping hot. The water came in handy. I started off at a good pace. I was hungry and hadn't eaten much all day. I slowed down. But I finished.
I'm never doing that again.
Hey, but you did it. Hey, you even licked the plate clean. Did you know about how much time you had left?
You said out loud 2:45.
2:45?
The store record was safe, but I still got a t-shirt and bragging rights.
I was gonna say, I was looking forward to lunch, but something about watching you eat a homewrecker is like, now I'm full, you know what I mean?
The homewrecker has been part of Hillbilly Hot Dogs for 20 years, but it almost came to an end last summer when Sherry's weenie supplier went out of business. Who makes a 1 pound hot dog?
I really didn't know what to do. And I turned to a very good friend of mine by the name of Guy Fieri, and I said, I don't know what to do. I'm lost. And so he said, I got you. That's all he said, I got you. And the next thing I know, I had chefs from all over calling me, going, give me specs, give me information, do you have any left on hand, which we did. So they had those to look at, go from, and we ended up with Vienna Beef, and they've done a phenomenal job.
Sherry said that after Fieri visited Hillbilly Hot Dogs in 2007, he stayed in touch.
And he's always just been my good friend, yeah. When my husband died, he called. He called me quite a few times just to make sure I was okay. Yeah, his heart is in the right place. He's a beautiful man.
And Fieri helped her get a really decent hot dog. I was proud of my homewrecker t-shirt, but you probably shouldn't do something like that more than once. But looking at the Hillbilly Hot Dogs menu, below the original homewrecker, there's something called the Widowmaker. It's a 2 pound weenie with 4 pounds of toppings. I wonder how fast somebody could finish that thing. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Bill Lynch in LeSage.
That's it for this edition of West Virginia Week. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you back here again next week. As always, you can see these stories and much more at wvpublic.org. I'm Maria Young.